Hey folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Will Rigby is our guest today, and we're talking about the brand new reissue of the DB's debut album, Stands for Decibels. 44 years after its initial release, it's out for the first time on vinyl in the United States of America. How that happened, we'll talk all about it in this podcast. Will, amazing drummer. This is one of my favorite bands, one of my favorite records, so very much looking forward to talking to him. If you are a DB's fan, if you look in our archives at wfmu.org/Michael, you can find, I think, 2 interviews with Peter Holzapfel of the DB's and 4, including 1 live appearance of Chris Stamies. So lots of DB's stuff available at wfmu.org/Michael. I should also mention that Will Rigby has made some great and interesting solo records, some albums, some singles over the years. Check those out. And we did not at all get to his career, you know, in between DB's reunions, etc. But he plays on records by his ex-wife Amy Rigby, his current wife Florence Dorr, our old friend Laura Cantrell, and all kinds of people. In and out of his career. It's a super interesting discography, including recently he plays on Sarah Shook and the Disarmers' Night Roamer record. So just interesting guy, interesting drummer, one of my favorite records. So I hope you will enjoy this. This is me and Will Rigby talking about Stands for Decibels. All right, there are the DB's from the brand new reissue of Stands for Decibels, and I think Will Rigby is on the phone with us. Good morning, Will. How are you?
Good morning, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing great. One of my personal top 10 LPs. Just a real basic question. Do you like it? Do you think it represents what was best about the band at that time?
I think it's a fair representation of where we were at. Certainly, those are the songs that we were playing then. And I think it's a pretty well-recorded record. I don't, you know, it's not the greatest recorded record of all time, but it sounds good.
You guys are from North Carolina. Am I right that there's a lot of New York City in that record, that if you'd never moved north and recorded it in North Carolina, it would have sounded differently? The band's sound would have evolved differently?
That's a good question. Although, I mean, I very much think of it as a New York band. It was started in New York. Most of us lived there the whole time that the band existed. And yeah, we were New Yorkers.
So what was the New York music scene like? Did you guys find your place quickly? It's sort of like right after the first wave of CBGB band discovery. It was sort of in the beginning of that second wave.
Yeah, I'd call a second wave of New York new wave scene, or whatever you want to call it. Certainly we're not part of the first wave, but it was there was a fair amount of camaraderie. You know, everybody was kind of doing their own thing. There's not too much musical similarity between the DB's and the Bush Tetras or Lydia Lunch or anybody like that, but we all knew each other and to a certain extent were supportive of each other.
Were gigs easy to come by?
We played regularly. Believe it or not, it took us a while to really get good gigs at CBGB's. They kept booking us at, like, you know, Tuesdays and Wednesdays for quite a while. And it's sort of like, do you get a following because you get good nights, or do you get good nights because you have a following? It's a bit of a catch-22. But anyway, we eventually were headlining shows in New York after 2-3 years.
Let's talk about CBGB's just for 1 second, because you brought it up. I mean, I always thought it was a really good sounding club. It was a good place to hear a band play music. Was it? Did it pay okay? You know, was it a decent place to play other than the bathroom downstairs?
It was. You know, it was a dive. But yeah, it sounded good in there. I have good memories of seeing bands there, for sure. I saw lots of shows there, that many which are very memorable. Played very many shows there, many of which are memorable and some of which are not. The way we thought about CBGB's, like in the early 80s, was that they were trying to live off their reputation, like nationally and even internationally that it was such a great place. But in reality, they booked like six bands a night and nobody really made any money as a result.
Yeah. It did seem like they kind of took their eye off. They were sort of became a t-shirt selling company more than a music loving company anyways. So tell me about just leading up to the making of this record. Tell me about what else you guys, were you doing non-music jobs? And tell me about like your rent and just prices and I always like to remember how cheap New York was once upon a time.
Yeah, it really was pretty cheap back then. We had jobs. Chris and I worked at a restaurant. Peter worked at a record store. Gene was always kind of like mysterious about what he was doing, but I think he was buying and selling guitars.
So how much did this band rehearse? Is this a band that rehearsed a lot or a little or medium?
One thing I think about the DBs is we rehearsed a lot. Yeah, I would say we probably rehearsed 20, 30 hours a week. We rehearsed a lot, and we worked up a lot of new songs. We had like a large song list at any given time. We moved through songs a lot and, you know, got tired of them, but we still had the old ones when we got tired of them. So we just kept learning more and more songs. But we rehearsed a heck of a lot.
So when Stands for Decibels was recorded, how long had the band been together?
I believe that the recording began in 1979. I'm not sure, either that or early 1980. My memory is it took a long time to record, but in reality, it was probably more like a year, a little over a year. It came out in January of 81. The 45 of Black and White, I believe, came out, I want to say it came out in 1979, but I'm just not really sure. Somebody else could probably figure that out. I guess I could look at the label and see. But the single came out first, and my memory was it came out a good year before the album did.
Tell me how the songs were presented to the band. Did the songwriter play a demo? Did it just come in and run it down with the guitar, and then you'd sit in the rehearsal space and each think of your parts? Because the sound of the records sort of suggests that there's a lot of group effort in the arrangements of the songs.
Yeah, I would say that we basically came up with our own parts, although Chris in particular had like pretty specific ideas about what he wanted. I would say that Gene, the bass player, pretty much came up with his own parts. And I, you know, mostly came up with my own parts. I can think of a few songs of Chris's where he had something specific in mind for the drums. A good example of that would be Ask for Jill, which is on the second record. It's not on Stands for Decibels, but that's a part that Chris made up. He couldn't play it, but I could.
So I didn't realize that the record wasn't sort of recorded in one go, that it was a bunch of sessions that stretched out, you know, maybe over a year. So did some of the songs get played a lot live before they were recorded?
I would say at least half of them we had played live a lot before we recorded them. Song like Big Brown Eyes or Bad Reputation, those got played a lot. I think they probably all got played live before we did it, but a song like She's Not Worried probably didn't get played so much before we recorded it.
So walk me through the general way you guys recorded the songs on this record. Was it, you know, four pieces live? Was there a live vocal? Was, you know, was it endless overdubs? What was the sort of general timeline to get a song from start to mix?
Well, we do like a basic track, which was guitars, bass, and drums. And I don't think there was any live vocals. I think the vocals were all overdubs. But I would say some of the record, it's like what you hear is the track and the vocal recorded on top of it and not a whole lot else. But, you know, there's overdubs on several of the songs. There's extra guitars and keyboard parts.
The band has, you know, famously has two songwriters who generally didn't collaborate. They each would bring songs in. Tell me what the sort of push and pull of having two voices in the band, what did that bring to the process and to the end result?
I'd like to think that it made the overall picture stronger. I'm not sure I'm objective about that, but I would like to think that it had a beneficial effect, in that the more talent, the better, I guess, would be a way of putting it.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I think it's part of the whole DB sound, is that the contrast between those guys and maybe what rubbed off on how they each rubbed off on each other. I don't know. It's interesting. So let's talk about Alan Betrock. He and the group are listed as the producer of this record. I think I spoke to Peter one of the times I interviewed him, and he said that really Chris is sort of the main person who produced the record, and Alan's job was more of the sort of bring energy and, you know, help you guys make some decisions. Is that, you know, is that fair?
The way to think about his involvement would be more like what an executive producer does on a movie. And that is, like, he came up with the money, and that's his main contribution, which was substantial. And he was there for most of the recording, not all of it, but he didn't have a lot to say. He would, like, if you asked him a question, he would answer it, but he didn't really volunteer any, like, directions or don't do this, don't do that, don't do this. He didn't really have much in the way of direction in terms of the actual recording process.
And I think on the original record, there are no mix credits, but in some of the material that has come with the re-release, Scott Litt and Don Dixon and Martin Rushent all mixed different parts of the record. Did it start with one guy trying to mix the whole thing, or was it just because it was recorded in different batches, it was mixed in different batches?
Yeah, I frankly knew almost nothing about mixing back then, so I was a little bit oblivious. But it was all recorded so cheaply and in fits and starts that when it came to mixing, we just kind of did whatever we could figure out to do. And somehow we got time at the Power Station, which was this hot studio at the time in New York, to do a couple of mixes. And we were just assigned a house engineer who was Scott Litt, and that's how we met Scott. And he was, like, super into it and started coming to our shows, and got to be pals with him. And before you know it, we asked him to produce the next record. And as far as Martin Rushent goes, I think that might have been the record label's doing. There was a British record label, so they brought Chris and Gene, I think it was, over to participate in some mixing, which was done with Martin Rushent, well known for having produced Buzzcocks records and stuff like that. And then I guess about half of it was produced, mixed by Don Dixon in Mitch Easter's studio, drive-in studio, outside of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, which would have been just about the first record that ever came out of that studio. I'm not really sure exactly what record was the first, but it definitely, like, predated REM recording there.
So were you guys happy with the final results? I mean, you personally, were you happy with how the record came out?
Yeah, we were happy. I mean, I can always, like, nitpick and say, I wish this sounded better, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, we were pretty happy with it.
I mean, you say that it was cheaply recorded, but to me, there's a lot of ingenuity in, there must be, because it sounds so inventive to me. Do you hear that?
Yeah, I think that we had no shortage of ideas. Chris in particular had lots and lots of overdub ideas, and I guess we did about as many of them as we could. I don't remember going hog wild with, like, overdubbing, but But there's plenty of ideas in there. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah. No shortage of ideas is good. But there's also an economy to the way the band laid down the rhythm tracks that's very consistent. And but then the extra ideas kind of really, you know, make the whole thing mixed up. I think this is a little bit why this record's so interesting to people. So is there an explanation why this record wasn't released in the USA at the time? We're talking about 1981. There was, you know, a lot of records labels were trying to get in on whatever this new music thing was. I think maybe they didn't exactly understand it. I've never understood why the first two DB's records never were released in the USA at that time. Is there some idea why that you have?
I think that we were seen by American record labels as not particularly commercial. I mean, that's, I guess, a little bit of an obvious observation, but it was dead air. I don't think we were we weren't very polished, especially on stage. We had a bit of a reputation for our equipment breaking down, specifically our amps on stage. But even aside from that, I think we were just seen as being inconsistent, which is, you know, partially true.
That's interesting, because there are some, you know, the first, they've been releasing some digital singles to sort of tease the new re-release. And, you know, those songs are so strong and so catchy. I don't know. It doesn't make sense to me. I mean, I assume at the time it didn't make sense to you. I assume when you finished recording and mixing this, that the band thought, we will get an American record deal. Is that fair?
We certainly wanted to and hoped to and would have preferred that had happened. It was a bit of a mystery to us, like, why won't anybody sign us? But, you know, no label offered. I think there was maybe one label that was basically a distribution company with a label offered to put it out, but they were like, it was a small label, and we decided it wasn't worth it to go with that one.
So I had never heard of Albion, but I do remember that when this record and Repercussions came out, they were both pretty easy to find. At least in New York City, they were pretty easy to find. Everybody I know had a copy of that record. I mean, I remember in high school, and those records were blowing a lot of people's minds. From the band's perspective, how the record was received on a larger scale than, you know, me and my friends in my friend Isaac's living room having our minds blown. Did you guys sense, you know, did the ball get rolling that this record was going to be a special record and have a long life? Was that apparent in the, you know, a year or so after the release?
Well, looking back, it's nice that like it's considered worthy of re-release 43 years later. That much is for sure. At the time, it was a really long, slow climb to, I was going to say self-sufficiency, but we never really got to a point where we were making a living at the music. So not in the DBs anyway. So it was pretty much of a struggle. You know, we toured small clubs and didn't even do that all the time, and just continued, you know, rehearsing and working up new material as long as we were together, which was several more years.
Is the sound, I mean, it's such an interesting combination of things. Was there conscious influences? Did you guys think, did you speak out loud, oh, you know, we should try to sound like this or like that, or incorporate this or in that? Or was it just a more organic thing?
I would say organic would be a way to describe what we did. There was not a whole lot of premeditation in terms of, like, you know, trying to write a hit. I mean, we wanted hits, but in terms of, like, we weren't, like, tr- trying to sound like the radio in particular.
Did you sit in practice and think, oh, you know, we need to bring more soul into this, or more AM radio of our childhood, or more British Invasion, or more Big Star, or more classic rock but not so dumb, or, you know, just there's so many influences, or more of the sort of New York art rock scene but not so jagged, you know, there's sort of like, I just hear so many different influences in the music, but it's so well balanced, if that makes sense.
Well, we were, you know, the sum total of our influences, I guess, and all of the ones that you named. I would say that, you know, 60s AM top 40 radio was, to me, that seems like the single biggest influence, although there's obviously a lot of, like, not that, you know, Big Star or The Move or whoever that wasn't, like, exactly AM radio music. But I would say the single biggest foundational music for us would have been, like, the music we listened to growing up, which was the radio.
Yeah. Speaking of radio, tell me about the importance of college radio at the time, you know, the early 80s, and what that did for your band.
Yeah, that scene was really heating up in the early 80s, and kind of its influence kind of peaked in the mid 80s, I believe, and then sort of eventually got co-opted into what they started calling indie or alt rock or whatever. But it was definitely important to the DBs. Whenever we got on the radio in any given town, people would come to our shows, and when, you know, in places where we weren't getting played on the radio, it was a lot tougher. But yeah, it was a big deal.
Yeah, I think that was in some ways kind of a golden age when, you know, fanzines and independent record stores and, you know, all these things kind of worked together, and bands could, you know, find new fans without being part of the major thing. And it didn't last too long, but it was amazing when it happened. Let me remind folks that Will Rigby is our guest, drummer of the DBs and a million other bands since then. But once again, the original lineup of the DBs tour starts September 7th in Raleigh, North Carolina, and goes through Washington and Philly and Athens and St. Paul, Chicago, Milwaukee,
and Jersey City.
Yes, right here in Jersey City on the 15th at White Eagle Hall. You can go to thedbs.com for tickets and information. It's the original four guys. So you said, like, in 1981 when this was out, when you toured, were you on any weird bills? Did you have to open for any weird bands? Was there... you know, was there any of that craziness going on?
Oh, let's see. The craziest tour we ever did was our very first tour, which was flying everywhere. And we were flying on tickets. This is the summer of 1980, and we were flying on tickets that were in other people's names. They weren't in our names. This is, like, to give you an idea how different things were back then. The airline really didn't care that it wasn't the person on the ticket. And that was in the early days of airline deregulation, when things went really crazy, and they did things like all the flying you can do for, like, a certain amount of time for a flat fee. And our manager booked not one but two bands on the same tickets. They were like, it was like 2 weeks or 3 weeks, all you can fly, and Eight-Eyed Spy used them, and the tickets were in the names of the members of Eight-Eyed Spy, which was Lydia Lunch, George Scott, Pat Irwin, Jim Sklavunos, and Michael Palmgarden. So they used those tickets for like a week or 10 days, and then we used the tickets for like a week or 10 days, and... it was, I believe it was Eastern Airlines, and I want to say it was $50 for all the flying you could do, but I think that number's low. But it was really cheap, and we flew to, I think it was five or six different cities in a week. But the one limitation on the tickets was you couldn't go to the same city twice. You had to fly to a different one every time. And so we couldn't go to the ones that Eight-Eyed Spy had already gone to. We had to go to the other ones. So that was like a really crazy tour.
And that worked out? You never got caught? You never got rejected?
Yep. That's... It's crazy as heck to even think that it could possibly have happened, but it really did.
That's unbelievable. So let's talk about this tour. Do you four guys get in a room and the sound comes back right away, or is there some kind of work involved?
Well, we're working on it. It's been a long time since we've played. So we just rehearsed the three of us. Gene wasn't there, but we rehearsed the three of us yesterday, and I was relieved that I remembered how to play the songs more or less. It's definitely like knocking the cobwebs off, but it sounded like the songs. It'll get better with more rehearsal.
Now, you mentioned Gene. Let's talk about his bass playing from a drummer's perspective. I think he is such an interesting and innovative bass player. He kind of, you know, he holds it down, but there's a lot of melody and counter melody and hooks and all kinds of stuff. He's very unusual. Do you agree from a drummer's perspective?
When I listen back to old DB's recordings, the first thing I think is, man, what a great bass player. And, you know, we had good songwriters, and you know, I was a pretty good drummer, but those bass lines are just remarkable. He's just an incredible bass player, and he's still just as good as he ever was.
Hmm. Yeah, I agree. He is very... I mean, it's a great band, right? And it is a band in that sense that all... There's a chemistry that is sort of like all, the sum of all four parts is greater than 100% somehow. But, you know, just I agree. We need to point out what a unusual and great bass player Gene is. And together, you guys have a rhythm section. I mean, I guess you must... I don't think you're giving yourself enough credit, too, because when you're listening to whatever Gene's doing, you and him are locking in, you know, as a pair.
Yeah, there was definitely a greater than the sum of the parts thing with me and Gene. And I would say that still exists. And the reason that I know that is we did some touring with Florence Dorr, who's my wife, when her record came out a couple of years ago. Gene played bass and I played drums. And it was still like DB's days in that... There's just a thing that Gene and I do, and it's partly just from having played together for so long, but it's still there. So hopefully it'll still be there next month.
Yeah, I heard that Florence Dorr tour was mind-blowing, and I'm sorry I missed it. Definitely next time out. Do you go back further? I mean, do you go back to teenage years or childhood with these guys? How long have you known them?
I go back to the third grade with Peter. We met in we were in the same third grade class. Chris was in the same elementary school. He was a year ahead of us. So I saw him in the lunch line back then, but I didn't know him. And, you know, gradually as we all became musicians, like more like in junior high and especially high school, everybody kind of knew each other because it was a pretty small music scene in Winston-Salem. So everybody kind of knew each other.
Do you have a favorite song on Stands for Decibels?
Well, Black and White is such a classic that it'd be kind of like crazy not to mention that one first. I'm pretty partial to Cycles Per Second. I'm very proud of the drum part on that one. So I'm a little partial to that one. I'm in Love is certainly a really great song. Big Brown Eyes is a great song. I mean, I think they're all good songs.
Yeah, they're all amazing songs. So it's 44 years or so later, and this record is still finding new audiences. It's still inspiring, you know, people like me who picked it up when it came out in 1991. You know, I think it still sounds fresh. It's definitely sounds unique, and I think maybe because it was one of the first records that did what you were talking about before. It sort of fused the best of the 60s and 70s music with something new. It sort of had a contemporary feel, and it spoke to people because it has a point of view, you know, from the songwriting and the playing and the sound, everything about it that sort of wasn't represented in what else was on the radio. And it also has this sort of heart on my sleeve sincerity that Peter and Chris both do. It's very unusual to me. To me, you guys were sort of taking this palette of music that people shared and you did something different with it. I'm sort of rambling, but do you agree that that is why this record is still blowing minds, or do you have some insight into why people, you know, we're putting this record out again now and people are very excited about it, new and old?
Well, we're really super pleased that it's well remembered enough to merit re-release. And in fact, on vinyl, it's the first time it's ever been released in the United States, which is just
wild,
ridiculous. I mean, yes. It's just ridiculous that it took so long. But it is nice to be remembered. And I will say, like, in terms of all those influences, one thing that I think comes across to me is we weren't really punk rockers. And we're like the same age as like Johnny Rotten and stuff, but we weren't really like, we loved punk rock, but we weren't really punk rockers. But I think the urgency of that scene had a big effect on us. There's like an urgency to the music that is very much informed by the punk rock scene. Or punk rock music.
Yeah, I think urgency is a great word, a perfect word. Yeah, yeah. Do you share the understanding that this is an important band to people? Is that something that's part of your life's understanding? You know, just because dealing with people over the years, just people letting you know that. Do you feel that? I guess that's what I'm getting after.
Well, I mean, I've heard enough people say that, you know, this band was important to them and stuff like that, that I believe them. But, and, you know, in terms of my own perspective, it's just like, well, you know, we never made any money, so I take it with a grain of salt. And it's nice to be remembered. It really is. We don't, like, take that lightly.
Yeah. September 15th at White Eagle Hall in Jersey City, the original four members of the DBs playing songs from Stands for Decibels. Also, Repercussions is coming out on vinyl in October, and you can go to thedbs.com to buy a t-shirt or a black and white vinyl copy of this record, or to see all the tour dates, etc., etc. You mentioned black and white. I agree. This is a number one hit record. I mean, how is it not a number one hit record? Let's hear that one now. Is there anything we need to know about the recording of this record? Do you remember anything specifically about cutting this record or about the first time Peter brought the song in and you heard it and what you thought about it, or the first time you sat in the recording studio and heard a mix down and thought, wow, this is really something?
Well, I will say that it didn't start off as fast as it wound up. That's the one thing I remember, is it started off more, not mid-tempo, but not at the breakneck speed it eventually wound up at. But I will add that the record came out, it sped up a little. We just sped up the mix a little tiny bit. So if you're trying to play guitar along with it, it might seem like you're out of tune, but it's really just that the record is sped up a little bit.
Oh, I never knew that. That's incredible.
Not a lot. It's not a lot. It was fast. We played it fast. It's just little tiny bit sped up.
Oh, that's an old trick. Yeah, it kind of builds the excitement. All right, let's hear that now. Will, thank you so much for giving us some insight of this record and this terrific band and those days.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Michael. It's an honor to be on the world's greatest radio station, WFMU. We'll be right back.
I done enjoyed.